This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 28 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winsky, and today we'll be taking a look at the NWA of 1989, although we did this in episode 6, that was in August, and this time we'll be in May 20th, 1989, just after the Wrestle War 89 pay-per-view, the Music City Showdown that was highlighted by the classic Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat match. The third one that was officially televised. There were much more that are out there. But, of course, neither Flair nor Steamboat is actually on this show. But certainly we'll have Ric Flair's heated rival from the time period coming up. But first, some plugs just real quick. You're probably listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Do give that a subscription and rating on iTunes, Apple Music, whatever the hell you want to call it. Also, check out theplacetobenation.com to make your Amazon purchases. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon. Check out the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed with a couple of shows that I've called our automatic listens for me. The Place to Be podcast, the Mothership, as it were, and the Our Vantage Point podcast. Dear friends of the show here, the brother band of Greetings from Allentown, and one of the guys, when I DM with the guys from the OVP podcast, I never know which one I'm actually talking to, so it's just, okay, I'm just talking to their show. And they alerted me to the audio issue with last week's The Sunny Show episode. See, if you downloaded the show right away in the first couple of hours, you may have noticed that you were only able to hear out of the right earphone for about the first 15 minutes. And that was because of the bizarre nature in which I recorded that show. I recorded the intro last. I went through and recorded the body of the show, and then I came back and did the intro part leading up last. And when I imported it in, what I must have done was I must have hit the right key, the right arrow, because it all of a sudden just moved all the audio to that one side. Luckily, because it was the last thing that I did, I was able to just go into Audacity, hit undo, and it was able to recenter it right then and there, and then I just exported it again and re-uploaded. So that's some boring audio stuff there. And just an apology for anybody who listened to that and became suddenly off balance. Because I know sometimes I feel that way. If I have headphones where one ear isn't working, I just have to switch out because I just can't do it. Even like some songs in mono from back in the day. I'm thinking Wooden Ships by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It's a great song, but you have different parts of the song in different ears. Like the beginning of the song is only in one ear, and then it kicks in with another and all that. But that's audio from nearly 50 years ago. As for my contact, you can reach me via email, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. After I post the show, I do tweet out a series of footnotes, which sometimes includes GIF files. I am not one of the professional GIF file guys. I do my best taking the GIFs from YouTube, and I hope to have a few for this week. I know last week I was a little late on them because I've been traveling all over. I've had a bit of a hectic travel schedule the last couple of weeks, going to Milwaukee, and then this past weekend I was in Baltimore, which I'll be getting into later in the show because they're going to mention the 1989 Great American Bash, which of course took place at the Baltimore Arena, which is now the Royal Farms Arena, and I was walking past literally just the other day as I record this. It's a rather interesting-looking building in downtown Baltimore. Oh, yeah, and back to the plugs. Facebook, GF Allentown, so look for me there. So why go back to the NWA of 1989? Well, first of all, it's now been 22 episodes since then, so nearly 5 months. So enough time has passed that I can revisit the time period. Also, it's a different part of the year. There's so many glorious parts of the NWA slash WCW in 1989 that I could drop in at any point in the year. I know at some point it'll probably be like November, around the time of the Clash. But honestly, I was looking back at last week's show, and it was kind of a weird show personally for me, because during the recording of it, if I came off as very angry, for whatever reason, I wasn't in as good of a mood doing that show. And I think a lot of it had to do with the JBL slash Bradshaw match. If, you know, listening to it, you could tell that he really just pisses me off for many, many different reasons, as he does a lot of people. And that's not really what I want from this show. I like to watch wrestling as an escape. It is, after all, entertainment. And in general, I do like and respect the men and women who are in the ring. Except, of course, for JBL slash Bradshaw, who I don't like. So I thought, okay, it's important to take a step back here. Why don't I find something that I really, really like and celebrate that going forward, at least for a couple of weeks? And so that is how I got the idea for this concept. There are other podcasts out there. They can do a 30-week WrestleMania journey or some sort of package thing where they go through the new generation pay-per-views. I'm a one-man show, and I really don't want to stay on one thing for that many consecutive weeks, because I might get bored with it, because after all, I'm the only person here recording this, unless you want to count my cat, who's just walking around right now saying, "Where the hell is my food?" And no, it's not just the NWA of 1989, although it is just tremendous to watch, because the action in-ring is, in general, there are some exceptions, of course, that we'll get to in the course of this episode, is really, really good. And there's very, very strong heels in the promotion, such as we'll see the great Muta on this show. And there are many others. And babyfaces like Sting and babyface Ric Flair during this time, who have always said they could have made a lot more money if Ric Flair had been a babyface for a longer period of time and didn't keep fighting the fight to turn heel all the time. And as for the television, yes, they did have their snafus because WCW, hashtag because WCW. I believe there was one show in the summer that they just completely forgot to air and it went missing, so they aired the show the week before twice in a row. One of those only in WCW kind of accidents, and I guess in that IWCCW that showed Tony Atlas versus Vic Steamboat 100 times or whatever. But on the TV, we were treated to such things as the commentary team on this episode of NWA Pro, which is Bob Caudle and Lance Russell. And I was very surprised to see these two guys together. Bob Caudle is someone that when I was watching the bigger shows, because I would really kind of only have access to that before instead of the week-to-week TVs, on Capital Combat 90 and some of the other shows, Bob Caudle comes off as a little bit sleepy and sluggish to me as a broadcaster. But I appreciate him a lot more on a week-to-week basis, having seen some of his work in Smoky Mountain and on the week-to-week Mid-Atlantic and NWA shows. I like him a lot better in that setting than on the big pay-per-view shows. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but I just like him better in that setting. And he's joined here by Memphis legend, the iconic Lance Russell. And what a treat it is to have Lance Russell on this show today. And he does such a fantastic job. I mean, he's kind of everything I want out of a wrestling broadcaster. He's not too over the top. He kind of plays it straight, but he expresses a humorous disdain for the heels when they do things on this show. And he has one tremendous heel in particular. And you probably notice I'm not saying his name yet, because it is the reason for this two-episode series that I am doing. Because, as I said, I wanted to get away from the JBL thing and Bradshaw. Like, oh, I hate that guy. And I called him a copy of a copy of a copy. So I thought, what better than to go back to the original article, the man himself, the oracle of wrestling, Mr. Terry Funk. So what I'm calling this two-episode arc is a fortnight of funk. Now, the music you're hearing underneath this is actually... So I decided to call this a fortnight of funk, and I thought, I wonder if that term has ever been used by anybody else before. Of course, a fortnight is more British English than it is American English, and it means 2 weeks. I've used the word fortnight on this podcast before, I think. It was one of the earlier episodes or whatever. And yes, there is, has been a usage of the term fortnight of funk. It is actually the album name of Young Backpack Adventure. I don't know anything about this group, but the music appears to be funky. You can hear it underneath here right now. So I figure, what better, you know, it goes together with what I'm getting at here. And Terry Funk in 1989 is so enjoyable. And kind of like Sonny, where the reason why I did last week's show was because I had purchased Sonny's book. I also have recently purchased Terry Funk's book, which I forget exactly when that came out. I've seen conflicting thing, but of course the name of the book is Terry Funk More Than Just Hardcore by Terry Funk, Scott E. Williams, and the foreword or afterword was written by Mick Foley. I've kind of been jumping around in the book and reading it piece by piece. The most surprising thing in reading Terry Funk's thoughts on his 1989 run in the NWA is getting the impression that he was not 100% satisfied with how everything went down. Of course, there was all the background politics of 1989 NWA, because they had a booking committee, they had Jim Herd, who wasn't, you know, entirely 100% on what he was doing at all times, as we know now. Terry was quite fond of saying that he was on the side of the NWA. He was not on the side of Jim Herd. He was not on the side of the booking committee. He's on the side of the promotion. So he was trying to think of the greater good and to make the angle the absolute best that it could. And it's kind of divided into two different parts here, where you have Terry Funk attacking Ric Flair at the beginning, and that kicks off the first part of it. And through that, he's wild and crazy, Terry Funk, and just a complete loose cannon in everything he does, and insulting Ric Flair, not really personally, but making fun of his nose and stuff like that. And he's just completely wild, and it's amazing. But that gets cut off at a certain point, because apparently Ric Flair's feelings might have gotten hurt, and also some complaints about viewership, although that happened more at the Clash in the late summer, early fall, when you had Funk putting a plastic bag over the head of Ric Flair, which prompted a lot of calls to WTBS, as they thought that Terry Funk was trying to straight up murder Ric Flair on television. So it's two different parts of the angle. He kind of, I don't want to say he got neutered, because he was still very good, but Terry, the greatness of Terry Funk is that you could give him just about anything and he would make it work as good as he possibly could make it. He is the great maximum effort guy in the history of professional wrestling. I've never not been entertained watching a Terry Funk match. I'm not going to screw around on my phone looking at Twitter or whatever when Terry Funk is on the screen. He has my undivided attention. Now, there's much more than Terry Funk on this show. We got the Fabulous Freebirds. The incarnation here is Terry Gordy and Michael Hayes, although it would not be for long. And Michael Hayes scored a huge upset victory over Lex Luger at WrestleWar, and this is during the brief period where Michael Hayes, tag worker, was the United States Heavyweight Champion. So we'll take a look at that coming up. As I mentioned earlier, we have the great Muta in action. He's still very new, only a couple months in. Ron Simmons is taking on Randy Rose, which struck me as a little odd since I didn't think one of them should be there, and I'm not talking about Ron Simmons. Dick Murdoch is in action. We have a special rookie challenge match, which, surprise, surprise, actually ends up being one of the best parts of the show. And a main event match between Kevin Sullivan and Eddie Gilbert, which to me just says, which one is the greatest Southern booker of all time? We will decide right here, right now. So why not just dive right into the show? The great Muta here against Tony Branch, who looks like he has his outfit on backwards, but he then turns around and it does look to be symmetrical. I thought he had the Bret Hart style tights on and had it the wrong way, which does happen more than you might think. The times that I've seen that in the past are not really coming to mind. Anyway, he's not important. The great Muta in 1989 sure as hell was important and kind of a revolutionary figure coming to the United States, and was unlike anybody that was seen in American wrestling at that time. And he debuted on the March 12th tapings of World Championship Wrestling, and on the debuted on the March 18th episode of World Championship Wrestling, billed as the Pearl of the Orient. Which Orient doesn't seem like something that's used these days. You'd hear Gordon Solie refer to somebody as Oriental, which really is more befitting a rug than a human being. Muta was pretty much on an undefeated run going up to this point. He had defeated the immortal Steve Casey at Clash of the Champions 6 with his finishing move, the Moonsault, which was certainly something that was extremely uncommon in American wrestling at that time. Unless you were watching, say, Leaping Lanny Poffo, but he was booked in such a way that it really didn't matter what he was doing in WWF and opening matches on house shows. Great Muta, completely different animal. He was set up to face the Junkyard Dog at WrestleWar, but the Dog no-showed. Showing true professionalism there. And Doug Gilbert, hero of the 1996 Royal Rumble. Which I'm laughing, but Doug Gilbert actually was a hero in that match because he played that Miz role of taking everybody's finisher when they hit the ring. So he's not all shooting on Jerry Lawler and all that. He should be known for something else. Muta was kind of a cool heel. He was a nominal heel here. He's got Gary Hart with him. And Gary Hart as a manager, I kind of go back and forth on. Maybe if I can ever get my hands on the vaunted Gary Hart book, perhaps I'll make up my mind on him one way or the other. But Muta was so cool. I just remember being 10 years old that, like, well, why should I hate him with all the cool stuff that he does? It's, again, that babyface moveset, and he's a heel, but he's only a heel because he's foreign. And as a kid, I'm being taught, you know, don't hate other people because they're a different nationality or race. So why should I hate this guy simply because he's Japanese? Of course, what he would do, and he had brought this from the great Kabuki, who, to me, he's the kayfabe father of the great Muta, apparently, who brought the spraying mist thing to the United States. The mist is kind of an interesting thing, and it's one of the most famous things about the great Muta. And as a matter of fact, my best friend Merrill, the reason why he actually knows who the great Muta is because of the whole mist thing. So I look into the mist, and I kind of wish I hadn't looked up how that actually works, because it's apparently It involves sometimes using a condom filled with the solution, and I don't really want to talk about it anymore. But apparently there are five kinds of mists in pro wrestling. Muda is generally used the green and the red mist. So here are the five kinds of mist. Actually, six kinds of mists in professional wrestling. Green, the commonly used mist, which is said to obstruct the opponent's vision. So just kind of your standard whatever. Red, quite often used, but is said to burn the eyes. Used by Gangrel, which was known as blood mist. Black, said to blind the opponent for several weeks. Tajiri used this on Nydia. Okay? It must have happened when I was checked out or something. Blue, sends the opponent to sleep. See, I would use that one, because then you get an easy pinfall that way. Yellow, paralyzes the opponent. Well, I guess that can pinfall there, too. Purple, cause momentary distraction and memory loss. Well, you can accomplish the same thing by just having somebody's music play while they're facing in the opposite direction, and they get distracted. Like when Chris Jericho's music played and Kevin Owens got rolled up at that pay-per-view. Or actually, he got speared by Goldberg, whatever it is. I've seen enough distraction finishes on Raw over the last few years that it really doesn't matter if I'm pointing out the correct one. And Muda is squashing the hell out of everybody at this time. So really, it's a kind of a five moves of doom he's got going here. It's a kick, the mist, which is the green mist in this case, a spin kick, a slam, and then the big moonsault for the fifth move, and he picks up the 1-2-3, and he really was just kind of a force of nature at this time. And you get to the end of 1989, and he's losing all of his matches in that Starrcade tournament, which, again, was another one of those bad Starrcade ideas, because you're going to have to book somebody to finish last, and if you're booking your top guys on the show, well, somebody's kind of come out of it not looking good. And Muda was back to New Japan Pro Wrestling shortly after that. Of course, he was a part of the Clash 10 cage match, but he could have had quite a run as a babyface where he didn't even have to talk, in my opinion. Just kind of his in-ring charisma would have carried the day. After the match, you get Gary Hart, and he's with Lance Russell and Bob Caudle. And he lays out a challenge to Sting. And the one thing I will credit Gary Hart for is he had a certain way with the language that I can't really describe. Most managers didn't talk like him. He wasn't buffoonish like the WWF managers. Maybe I prefer them to be a little bit more outlandish, like your Grand Wizard, Captain Lou, your Jimmy Hart WWF version, stuff like that. But Gary Hart, you know, he certainly had his good qualities. Well, Sting, he makes his way out, and he says that he has a friend in Japan who is going to help him here. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. But what I'm going to credit Sting for is I liked when he would come out and not have on any face paint and would have on sunglasses. Kind of made him seem like a real human being. Unlike the Ultimate Warrior, who I just could never really picture without the face paint. You'd see him without, I guess, later from time to time. But Sting actually came off as kind of a human being and did not do one of the great Sting Dorcas Malorcas promos. And this feud between Muta and Sting, originally the idea was to have Sting and Eddie Gilbert in the feud with Muta, but and then have Eddie Gilbert turn on Sting at some point, but that never came to fruition as Eddie Gilbert was tied up with other things, it seems. I believe he got hurt somewhere along the line, and also the fact that it was so telegraphed, apparently, that they decided just to not do it because it was obvious to everybody watching. But Sting and Muda had a very good feud through 1989. They had the match at the Great American Bash, where the title was held up, and then eventually Muda did win the television title. And it was a good feud, but I'm not sure it was the best for Sting, because if he's facing a cool heel, it might not give him the same benefit than him vanquishing somebody who is universally reviled. But hey, if I'm going to complain about the way Sting is booked, this might turn into a six-hour show, so I'm going to cut it right there. Bonus points, though, to Lance Russell for the way he refers to Sting as the Stinger.
The Stinger standing face to face with him out here. Dragon Shy doesn't scare him.
Well, he accepted that challenge right off of the bat there, Gary.
You may be face to face now, big boy, but before it's over, you're going to be belly down in a whole lot of trouble. I wait for it.
Speaking of managers, Lance Russell is with aspiring manager Teddy Long, who is now in that position because he had run a crooked referee angle, screwing over the likes of the Road Warriors at the Clash of the Champions, and then later Junkyard Dog and Randy Rose. But it's really more the Road Warriors that everybody was concerned about. He was banned first from refereeing championship matches, and then the Rose and JYD screwjobs got him banned or fired from officiating. So now he's looking to become a manager. And Lance is rather surprised to see Teddy there, still working for the NWA. And Teddy says that it is none of Lance's business who he's working for, and that he is negotiating with powerful investors. I wonder what that could be. Could it be some Nigerian princes who are looking to start up a promotion? Who knows? Or perhaps to buy the NWA, he said. Can you imagine Teddy Long? It would be like nothing but Battle Bowl pay-per-views with tag team matches. Teddy has an announcement, and that is that he is bringing somebody in, and that is in the form of Mike Shaw as Norman the Lunatic. And he gets a little bit of promo time here, and it's quite interesting, actually, to listen to.
I can't figure it out. Ever since I was a small boy growing up, walking around the fields, walking around my little town, people would always be running up to me, cheering me, aggravating me, saying, "You're so different. What's wrong with you? There's something wrong with you. I can't take that. I don't need that. I didn't do nothing. I was just trying to be myself." After all these years, people want to come after me. They want to ridicule me. They want to tear me down. You know something? You people never should have put me away. You never should have put me away. Because now it's time. You got to look back at me. And I'm here. I'm not going nowhere. I'm here. Now, you people will pay for the day that I took all the abuse.
Okay, first of all, the fake laugh at the end isn't really good. I'm giving that 3 DiBiases out of 10. It's still probably the best gimmick he would ever have, and it sounds awfully familiar. And to me, it sounds an awful lot like the Mankind vignettes leading up to his debut after WrestleMania 12. It seems like kind of the same concept of I was mistreated as a child, and now I'm this crazy person who's going to lash out. And Norman, in the beginning, was they kind of went overboard with the whole escape mental patient and the whole outfit and all that. But he was a legitimately scary dude. That's how he should have been portrayed. And then eventually, he just finds his way into a lovable, cuddly monster, I guess. So there was really kind of no in-between with him. Either he was one side of the spectrum, this just uncontrollable guy, or he was this teddy bear who was really just kind of ineffectual and useless and cannon fodder for guys like Sid. Goes back to Lance and Teddy, and again, Lance Russell, I just enjoy how indignant he is about this whole thing.
He's for real? Now, are you kidding me?
Hey, just a moment, Mr. Russell. You look like you're shaking in your boots, huh? But what you've just seen is a man that's a personal friend of mine. He was victimized just like me, so I don't care what you say and what they say. He never done it, all right?
Yeah,
he never did it, okay?
Okay, let's go to the ring now.
I'm
up to Rhubarb
Jones. Ring too, all right?
Yeah,
how about that?
Lance is so good at that back and forth. So the match we have next is Ron Simmons, who seems to be on every old WCW NWA show that I do from like 1989 to 1991. I think this is like the fourth Ron Simmons one. And yet, I haven't done a show where he's been in Doom yet. So, kind of funny how that works. I've kind of said all I could really say about NWA Ron Simmons at this point. And he's squaring off against Randy Rose. I'm like, wait a minute. I thought you lost the Lose or Leave Town match at Chi-Town Rumble 89. Well, as it turns out, of course, there was a story behind that match where Dennis Condrey no-shows the event and basically says you could take your pay-per-view payoff and shove it up your butt. And he is replaced in the match by Jack Victory, because he's the... Jack Victory is like the long man out of the bullpen for the NWA in 1989. Just stick him under a mask. If you don't even have a mask available, just say he's a member of the Midnight Express. Whatever you got. Jack Victory is there for you. And Randy Rose eats the pin, and of course the stipulation was the loser of the match would have to leave the NWA. But here we are, 3 months later, and Randy Rose is there. Well, the reason is there was an angle in March there. Randy Rose shows up at the World Championship Wrestling taping with Paul E, or he shows up next to Paul E and says, "Hey, I'm reinstated here." And Paul E's like, "Yeah, you're the reason why we lost that match." And he gets beaten down with the phone and by Jack Victory as well. It was actually Jack Victory versus Randy Rose where Teddy Long screwed over Randy, as I had mentioned before. So he was only here for a very brief period and really kind of a jobber to the stars, or even really like more of a pure jobber kind of role here. So this match here, okay, I actually watched this match on the airplane, either going to Baltimore or coming back from Baltimore, because I don't care if people are seeing me watch wrestling on an airplane. I'm going to let my freak flag fly, wear it loud, wear it proud. I watched Raw on my way back from Chicago on a flight a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to watch this on my little iPod. In this match, I'm going to warn you right now, it frustrated the hell out of me. Very similar to episode 18 when Bobby Eaton was facing off against whoever he was facing on that. I can't even remember who it was. So it starts out with a little mat work. Simmons rides Randy Rose, gets a full Nelson. Then he gets it again after Rose escapes. Then Rose gets a full Nelson on there. And it's just kind of, it looks a little bit sloppy. Things look a little disjointed here. Get a snap mare and a knee drop by Randy Rose. And then he is distracted by Teddy Long, who's hanging out at ringside and definitely seemed to be associated with Ron Simmons at this point, even though he was not formerly the manager of the former All-American Florida State, finished 8th or 9th in the Heisman Trophy balloting. I don't know, I haven't heard JR say that in a while, so I'll have to be reminded of that at some point. Teddy is more scouting the match here, it seems, that they're alluding to, and Rose misses the SD Jones Memorial Charge to the corner, but he doesn't actually go shoulder to the post, though. He kind of goes through the top and middle ropes and kind of hangs there awkwardly. But again, it's just kind of befitting of the way this match is going. Simmons ends up on the outside there and is sort of preening to the crowd. And Rose takes this opportunity to go up to the top rope, and you think, is he going to do a Macho Man Savage double axe handle from the top to the outside? Well, no, he's not, because Rose slips on the top rope and falls and then just kind of comes off the apron with a clothesline, which just looked horrific. Let's just say that 1989 was not a good year for guys named Rose. Randy, Pete, the list goes on and on. I think the only Rose who had a decent 1989 was Rose Nyland. Get a hard slam by Simmons, and he goes for the shoulder block off the second rope, but Rose gets out of the way of that, so that misses. Then Rose, I can't believe he tried this move at the way this match is going. He goes for the top rope sunset flip. Who does he think he is? Johnny B. Bad? 3 years before he'd come along. But Teddy is up on the apron, and the referee is distracted by him. I don't know why he feels the need to talk to Teddy Long. You know, why not just turn around and focus on actually calling the match? I feel like I have my kayfabe hat on again. I mean, if he's not doing anything, if he's not actively interfering in the match, if he's standing on the apron, so what? It doesn't really matter. Focus on your job, referee. Of course, the referee that I'm complaining about here is six-time referee of the year, Tommy Young, which is one of my favorite running jokes from the early episodes of Where the Big Boys Play. Whenever Parv would bring up, where did Tommy Young get these awards from? Because they seem to just be a figment of Jim Ross's imagination. So he's distracted by that. And of course, Rose lets the hold go. And we get a distraction roll-up, like it's a 2015 Raw. And Ron Simmons picks up the cheap win. And I don't know if this is the most horrible match that I've done on this show. But it was the one that annoyed me the most. And yes, I was on a Southwest flight at the time. But their seats are a lot better than they used to be. Okay, they're not that cloth thing that they were. They're more like leatherish now. So I was in a great deal more comfort than I would be on a Southwest flight versus, say, 10 years ago. So, yeah, I'm going to say that this was the biggest pile of shit that I have looked at in 28 episodes of Greetings from Allentown. And now we visit with somebody else who was razzed pretty good on an episode of Where the Big Boys Play. I listened to Wrestle War 89, Where the Big Boys Play, leading up and researching for this show. And Parv, again, kind of went off on Joe Pettisito, calling him an incredibly fat man and asking where exactly is his neck. It was quite a performance of fat shaming there. Pettisito, a very, very large man, but very associated with pro wrestling in the South, with the TV block that he had in Atlanta, and also for his role in Global Wrestling Federation and getting that off the ground, which is what I knew him more for, although I remember seeing him on TBS in the early days of watching WCW after TBS came to my cable system, my hometown, which was later in 1989 than this. The name of the segment is Joe Pettisito Knows, and what he knows in this case is that the Road Warriors were screwed at Wrestle War 89, and it was a different kind of screwing than what they got at Clash 6. In this case, Nikita Koloff, although it was flat-top Nikita Koloff, so about 20% of Nikita from 86 and 87, you know, at his peak. He was the special referee, and when they hit the Doomsday Device on the Varsity Club, Kevin Sullivan and Dan Spivey dragged Koloff out of the ring and beat the holy hell out of him. And that led to a disqualification, and the Varsity Club would retain the tag titles. But wait, do they retain the tag titles? Nope. We get the announcement that they have been stripped of it for their wanton abuse of officials. So now there will be a tournament set up for the World Tag Team Championship, which just makes me wonder, why the hell did you take the belts off the Road Warriors in the first place? And, you know, if you're going to do this, have somebody win it who would maybe hold it for a longer period than a month. Maybe there were injuries or circumstances that I don't know. From a storyline perspective, they deserve credit for not having the Varsity Club as part of the tournament and saying that, oh, you attacked a referee, so we're not even going to put you in the tournament to regain your titles. That makes a lot of sense. Certain sense that the NWA WCW didn't always show in the years going forward. The tournament would eventually be won at the Clash of Champions 7 by the fabulous Freebirds, who would actually transform themselves during the tournament. For the first round match, which was actually a quarterfinal because there were only 8 teams, they defeated the Road Warriors, this time by countout, as the Samoan SWAT team ran interference on the outside, thereby setting up that feud. So you get the Road Warriors away from the tag titles, which I guess a team like them didn't need them. So there's no need to put the title on them. You end up getting the Freebirds, the tag titles, which, as I mentioned, it started out as Gordy and Michael Hayes, and Gordy left a very, very quick run in the NWA, although he seemed to have a lot of impact for the short time that he was there, and he was replaced by Jimmy Garvin. So this is the start of the Jimmy Garvin, Michael Hayes version of the Freebirds, although Garvin was kind of an associate Freebird down in Texas before this. So he was kind of a natural fit, but the feel of the Fabulous Freebirds, you know, even though they were victorious here, was never quite the same. Jimmy Garvin, he's okay, but he is not 1980s Terry Gordy, and he's not Buddy Roberts. It just never quite felt right. But if you want to know more about the Fabulous Freebirds, episode 1 of Exile on Bad Street, Chris Zellner's podcast he does from time to time, does a 3-hour breakdown on the whole career of the Fabulous Freebirds. So do check that out if you want to hear more about them. Here we have the NWA top 10 decided by some phony baloney board of directors. And this is a rather interesting top 10. Of course, Ric Flair, despite his injuries suffered at WrestleWar, is the world champion. Number 10, Ron Simmons, who we just saw emerge victorious in that complete crap hole of a match. Eddie Gilbert is at number 9. Bob Orton is number 8. Kind of surprised to see him up that high, but he had a brief run here in the spring. Number 7 is Dick Murdoch, who we'll be seeing a little bit later. Number 6 is the Great Muta, who has not been pinned to this point, so he's working his way up quickly. Number 5 is Butch Reed, who nearly became a horseman early in the year and is now just sort of floundering until he becomes a member of Doom. Number 4 is Lex Luger, and this is where the controversy really starts. Luger has a promo later in the show when I'll get into it then. Number 3 is Sting. Number 2 is Michael Hayes because he is the United States champion. Ordinarily, you'd say, well, why isn't he number 1? Well, number 1 is Ricky Steamboat, as he, of course, just had lost the world title to Ric Flair. Now, Luger is very unhappy about his ranking at number 4, and I can't say that I blame him one bit about this. And Pedicino was kind of a dick here, saying, well, you lost, Lex, you know, you lost. You're number 4 now because you lost your U.S. title. And they show the clip from WrestleWar of him losing to Michael Hayes, and it was via interference from Terry Gordy on the outside. Like I said, he made a huge impact for the very, very brief period that he was in. He had a crappy ref bump there, so they doesn't see any of Gordy's interference. And then when Hayes is placed on top of Luger, Luger gets his foot on the rope, which is then shoved off the rope by Gordy. Now, the NWA board of directors, when deciding their top 10, why would they not take such a thing under advisement? They can clearly see the method in which Luger lost the match. There's a difference between, say, getting beat by Michael Hayes in 10 minutes, clean straight up with the DDT in the middle of the ring, and having his buddy on the outside knock you for a loop and then take your foot off the rope when you had effectively, you put your foot on the rope, it's a kick out of the pin. So really, he did not lose. From a kayfabe perspective, there's no way in hell that Sting should be ranked ahead of Lex Luger at this point in time. Because Sting, okay, he's not on Lex Luger's level at this point. Luger was a, well, 3-month United States champion, having beaten Barry Windham for it, and Windham, of course, was very highly regarded. Coming off Starrcade, he was being pushed as almost the equal of Ric Flair, and Luger put him away and was fairly dominant. So there's no way that Lex Luger should be ranked below Sting. So I'm with Lex here. He's
We're going to hear from him, and he is very ticked off. And now for the reason why I would sit through something like Randy Rose versus Ron Simmons. And that is Terry Funk is here, and he is with Lance Russell. And this duo, I could watch these two on camera for 8 straight hours and never once get tired of it. This is really just kind of an amazing segment here because, as I've mentioned, Lance's manner is so great. He's an upstanding man. He's very well-dressed. He's not too over-the-top. He doesn't act overly disgusted. He kind of acts naturally disgusted by Terry Funk in the way he carries himself. And Funk is his usual, he called Flair banana nose, making reference to Flair's large nose, which I mentioned in an earlier episode was something that I had neglected to notice for a very long time. I never really noticed Ric Flair having a large nose. I would notice stuff like, why does he wear his knee pads below his knee? Well, that's because he had skinny calves and he was very self-conscious about it. Before I play the Terry Funk promo here, I kind of want to read some excerpts from his book to kind of give an idea of where he was coming from at this point in 1989 and why he would have come in and his experience working in the NWA. I mentioned in the intro to this show how he kind of said that he was on the side of the promotion and he did find himself kind of stuck in the middle of this tug of war that was just constantly always going on in this promotion pretty much all the way up to the end. So here we go with before he comes in, where he's working down in Florida in Dusty Rhodes' promotion down there, where he was between getting fired from WCW and turning up in the WWF. Not long after I finished up with Dusty, I got a call from Jim Herd, the TBS executive running WCW, still calling itself the NWA, after TBS brought it from Jim Crockett, to come in for the Clash of the Champions show on April 2nd, 1989, where they wanted to honor past NWA world champions. I also announced the main event of Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat with Jim Ross. They wanted me to do an angle with Flair, and they wanted me to serve as a member of the booking committee. The booking committee was me, Ric Flair, Jim Ross, Kevin Sullivan, Jim Cornette, and a few other guys. They didn't exactly work together, though. There was a lot of division and conflict within that committee. I had no idea I was walking into a loaded situation because the committee wasn't in agreement with Herd. I walked into my first meeting completely unaware of the problems. When Herd talked to me about coming in, he'd made it sound as if things were smooth as glass. I ended up being the outside individual, almost alone, compared to everyone else in there. What was asked of me ended up being damn near nothing. It was a shocking situation. The conflict seemed to be a power struggle between the committee and Herd. The members of the committee, all of whom had put years into the wrestling business, felt Herd was inept. Herd, a former St. Louis TV station manager and executive with Pizza Hut, was fighting to show he was boss. If everyone had been on the same page, I think we'd have had a much stronger product. Here's an example of how little control over things I had. I brought in a talented young man to wrestle. Even though he put me over in his first match, I thought his talents were obvious, but they never brought him back. His name was Eddie Guerrero. Maybe you've heard of him. And yes, there is a Terry Funk Eddie Guerrero match on NWA television in 1989, but they didn't pick him up, and Eddie went back to Mexico, made his name teaming with Art Barr, and does the little stint in ECW in the mid-90s, and is back in WCW in 1995. So, Terry kind of given some insight there into the infighting. You would think that a committee with those guys on it, they're all very good minds, but when you have so many chiefs there, they're bound to butt heads and not agree. And, of course, they were always against Jim Herd to begin with. And Herd was not in any sort of position to manage these personalities. I mean, how the hell is he going to tell Jim Cornette what to do with a wrestling promotion? You think Jim Cornette is going to listen to anybody? You think Kevin Sullivan, who'd been around the block 600 times, is going to listen to some guy who was managing, you know, Pizza Hut before he got there? Even Jim Ross, I mean, you know, he's well known for being a little prickly behind the scenes. And Ric Flair, with all of his, I don't know what you call it, lacking of self-confidence at times and stuff like that. I mean, kind of out of character from what the way you would think of Ric Flair. He was very insecure a lot of the time. So Terry had a lot to battle against there. And even in the feud with Flair, as I mentioned, he was able to go kind of harder edge at the beginning and had to tone it down, which he wasn't entirely happy with having to do. He felt that it hurt the angle. And let me read an excerpt on that. "It ended up that just about the only thing I could affect was the stuff I was doing in the ring, although that was the program with Flair, which I was pretty pleased with. The program itself, after the initial attack, was my direction. It started when I came in the ring after Flair regained the title from Steamboat and challenged the new champion. When he pointed out that I'd been in Hollywood and out of wrestling for a few years and needed to work my way into contention, I went berserk and attacked him, pile-driving him onto a table. It ended with Flair being carried out while I screamed, 'He said I wasn't good enough!' The story was the attack would leave Flair injured for several weeks, and they would tease that the injury was serious enough that he might have to retire before he came back and got his revenge on me. While he was out, I cut some really intense promos on Flair, including one where I brought out a skinny Ric Flair imposter with a yellow stripe painted down his back." Yes, that had some good stuff. "Flair was really bothered by this stuff, and I was told to tone it down a little bit. I didn't see the problem, because I was the heel. The ending was going to be that Flair was going to kick my ass. I sure wasn't going to say all these outrageous things, only to beat up Ric Flair and then go home and hang up my tights." So, yeah, I mean, it sounds... Terry Funk comes off as perfectly reasonable for a man who participated in exploding ring matches in Japan. He's the most reasonable man who you'd ever hear from who would do those things. By the way, about the table spot in the Wrestle War, or the aftermath of the Wrestle War match there, I found it quite interesting that, of course, Wrestle War took place in Nashville, so both Harley Race and Ric Flair suffered either kayfabe or real injuries going through tables in Nashville. I thought that was kind of... I almost half expected Terry Taylor to want to go through a table in Nashville just so he could be more like Flair. How come... Did Triple H ever get injured trying to go through a table in Nashville? I don't know. Of course, greetings from Allentown listeners know an extra motivation for Terry Funk attacking Ric Flair, which I outlined a couple of episodes ago, which is that Terry Funk was very upset watching Clash of the Champions 3, the fact that John Ayers is sharing the stage with Ric Flair, and Ric Flair is clearly showing him up with his superior mic skills. And you're not going to do that to a beer-drinking buddy of Terry Funk. Now, yes, that might have gone unspoken, but I could tell he was standing up for his friend, along with all the other stuff. What is interesting from the book is that at that point in 89, he doesn't bring up, "Oh, I came back to the NWA because Roadhouse was coming out." Now, Terry Funk had been in other movies, such as Over the Top and a few others. But Roadhouse is the movie that I remember Terry Funk the most for, as one of Brad Wesley's henchmen. And God, I love that movie so much, even though my wife does not let me watch that movie when she's home. She would almost rather I watch German pornography than Roadhouse. I mean, that's how much she hates that movie. So he did not come back to the NWA to promote it. I always thought that it was kind of like a Batista thing. You know, Batista comes back 2014, wins the Royal Rumble, is supposed to win the world title at WrestleMania 30, and then will go on, carry the world title through the summer, promote Guardians of the Galaxy, and then drop it at SummerSlam to whoever, probably Brock Lesnar, as it would have turned out. But no, it wasn't that way. He doesn't bring out Roadhouse, at least in that part of the book. So, as I mentioned, I've kind of jumped around in the book. So maybe he does bring it up later and say that he came back to wrestling on a big stage like the NWA to, you know, kind of promote the movie. But, yeah. So here is Lance Russell trying in vain to corral the tour de force that is May 1989. Terry Funk.
Hey, listen, yeah, it's no picnic for me either out here, but if we're going to get an answer to it, you got to go to the horse's mouth to
get
it.
Oh, you got it, the horse teeth, yeah. No, John Ric Flair, and the banana nose, you picked up right on them both, didn't you, Lance?
Terry, I don't want to hear that conversation. I want to hear you explain to anybody how any sane man can do what you did in the moment of glory of Ric Flair, and there it is, we're looking at it.
I am not going to explain anything again. Why should I have to explain this? It's self-explanatory.
It really is.
I broke the man's heart. His neck isn't hurt. Oh. It's jammed. He's got some quack doctor saying that so he doesn't have to come back and face me again. I heard the vertebrae crunch, but it's not that bad. I've wrestled with worse injuries than Ric Flair right there. It's just the man doesn't have the guts.
He's in
now,
traction.
Will you please be quiet? Now, let's go on with it. Let's talk about the future. Forget about the past. Ric Flair is in the past now. He's not in the present. He's in the minor leagues. You're looking here at a major leaguer. That felt good, didn't it? Ric Flair. You know, we're going to talk about major leaguers.
Yeah.
Ric Flair is not even a minor leaguer now. He's a has-been. I am a major leaguer. I am just like Nolan Ryan, 42, and trying to teach you people what a true hero is today.
Okay, come on.
Now,
come on, Terry, listen. We've got a match up here we've waited for all night long. We've got a rookie challenge. The moment for two young fellas, equal ability. Hey, come on. You've lost our attention, Terry. We want to go to the ring for the official announcement. These young men are getting nice.
No, this is my...
Terry, we've heard all...
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a rookie challenge match.
No!
I could listen to those two guys bicker literally forever. It's so great. Lance trying to keep the show on track for this rookie challenge, which, boy, that is something else, especially with the two guys that are in it. And Terry just begging to get in more of his insults towards Ric Flair. A couple things I want to talk about during the promo. They show a clip of the pile driver that put Flair out. And that is one of the most protected pile drivers I've ever seen. Now, I haven't read Ric Flair's book. If I remember, the Kindle price on it is absurdly high. The last I checked, it's like $15. It's like, okay, I'm saving you the printing cost here by having it electronic. Why is it that much? Especially since it's an older book. It came out quite a while ago. It's not in the last 5 years. I mean, we're kind of... Ric Flair has been very much in the media, and God, we're all praying for his recovery as he was hospitalized about a week and a half ago. But, you know, the price of that book is a little bit high, in my opinion. So I have not read it yet. And I don't know if he addresses this at any point. But on that pile driver, he's basically doing a headstand on the table, which, to me, kind of mildly... ruins the spot a little bit because it's like he's doing a headstand and just kind of gets driven down into it rather than a normal pile driver where he would wrap his arms around Terry Funk's legs and just go down with it. I mean, I bet he was probably scared shitless because he was 40 years old and, you know, still had a lot of time left and did not want to expose his neck to any sort of injury. Let's say that what I've seen of the Randy Savage, Ricky Morton table spot from 1984, that one looked, more savage. Now, Terry Funk brought up Nolan Ryan, and of course my alarm bells go off because, oh my God, somebody mentioned baseball during the wrestling show, so now this opens the door for me to talk a little bit about Nolan Ryan, who was kind of, he wasn't so much on the comeback trail in 1989, it's that he had a bit of a revival that year. He had left the Houston Astros after 9 seasons. He was there from 1980 through 1988 and signed with the Texas Rangers, which is, I think, a little bit closer to his home in Texas, which I think is Alvin, Texas. I'm not sure of the geography. It's a big friggin' state. So he ends up with the Texas Rangers, who were then owned by future President of the United States, George W. Bush. And Ryan had his first 300 strikeout season in 1989 in 12 years. He had not reached the 300 strikeout plateau since 1977 when he was with the California Angels, which were probably the best years of his career when he was racking up 300 strikeouts a year regularly through the mid-70s, including a record 383 strikeouts in 1973. A year in which he also pitched 2 no-hitters exactly 2 months apart. Now, my wife's uncle actually played with Nolan Ryan on the California Angels. He was a catcher in the Angels system through much of the 70s and then finally made it to the big club on their division-winning team in 1979 and only played a couple of seasons. But the highlight of his career is probably in June of 79, a game against the Texas Rangers where he's the starting catcher and caught a two-hitter from Nolan Ryan, who outdueled fellow Hall of Famer Ferguson Jenkins in a 5-0 Angels victory. And Tom Donahue, the catcher for the Angels, he homered in the game as well, one of his 5 career home runs. So you got a home run off a Hall of Famer, which he is quite proud of every time I've spoken to him about his time in baseball. But back to Nolan Ryan. He is a lot like Terry Funk when you think about it, except for the fact that Nolan Ryan retired in 1993, which is 25 years ago almost now, and Terry Funk still works every so often. I think I saw that he's working at an independent show coming up in the very near future. So Ryan and Terry Funk both had incredible longevity. Both are beloved in the profession by fans and by peers. They're no doubt Hall of Famers in their respective professions. And they've also, I'm pretty sure, taken a shitload of Advil in their time, I must say.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Puri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Now it's time for the rookie challenge that Lance has been very excited about through the show and wanted Terry Funk to get the hell out of the way so that these two youngsters could make a name for themselves. And it is Lee Scott taking on Dwayne Bruce. And you may know who Dwayne Bruce is. He would go on to much greater fame as Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker. There is an article where both of these guys, both Lee Scott and Dwayne Bruce, are quoted from March of 1988 in the Chicago Tribune talking about the American Academy of Professional Wrestling in Lovejoy, Georgia. And this is actually when Dwayne Bruce is training to become a wrestler. You think of him being the trainer at the power plant that you never think of him, oh yeah, he had to come up through the ranks at some point too. And he trained in the same school at the same time with Lee Scott, and here they are in the rookie challenge. Now, Lee Scott, he is actually second generation in the wrestling business, and this is a post by the Gary Michael Capetta on the Wrestling Classics board that is actually from the year 2003. And Capetta said, Lee Scott was one of the nicest, most interesting guys on the road with WCW in the early 90s. He is actually a second-generation referee. His dad, Levi Scott, ref for the McMahons in New York during the 70s and maybe even into the early 80s. Lee has been a movie stuntman for projects filmed in South Carolina. Just a little background on a really good guy. So that's Gary Michael Capetta on Lee Scott, who's a very slight guy here. Of course, Dwayne Bruce as Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker was a short but very, very stout guy. But let's face it, these are two young enhancement talents, and 1989 Terry Funk is in the vicinity. So that means shit is about to go down. So they actually start working a match here. They work a hammerlock and then a side headlock. And Bruce ends up getting thrown into the ropes. And Terry Funk, who's hanging around ringside, kind of pacing back and forth, kind of runs back to trip Bruce. And now it's on. And Lee Scott is a little upset about that. And he gestures towards Funk on the outside. This is where the fun really begins. And it just reminds me, yeah, you can't spell funk without fun, and you also can't spell funk without F-U. So, here's where we start here. Funk throws some left hands in on Bruce on the outside of the ring, and then he gets him up for a pile driver and starts running backwards, kind of in the way if he was moving a couch and he was holding the couch and had to be the guy who goes backwards. He was kind of moving back like that. And they do have the blue mats out on the floor, so it's not the sick Ted DiBiase pile driver onto concrete by the Freebirds sort of thing. But still, really fun to see a running pile driver on the floor in 1989. So Lee Scott sees this, and he's very disgusted. He throws a kick from the apron, which Funk no-sells. So now it's into the ring. And this is hilarious, because Funk just runs Lee Scott out of the ring and then chases him to the floor and then just kind of throws him to the ground there. And Lance Russell's just a complete indignation, as he was during the interview. Terry, this is not your moment.
All right, Funk, it's not your moment. Get out of there.
It's done in like the same tone of voice as like when I see my cat eating string and like trying to actually swallow it and digest it or whatever. Like, get out of there, you know? And if you thought he was upset before, Lee Scott ends up taking the pile driver on the floor as well.
You're talking about sick, Bob. This guy, absolutely. He doesn't have a screw loose. He's got a whole head full of them. Going to pile drive him right down there on the floor. Terry Funk ruining what was going to be a great match and a great moment for these young guys. And as you said, he's already done that to Ric Flair. The pile driver on Dwayne Bruce. Also the pile driver on Lee Scott. And there you see the wild madman himself, Terry Funk, as he's still irate and when you get out of here. And here he comes back again. I tell you what, we're going to get out of here, man.
It was my moment.
Terry Funk comes back. Let's right now look at something more impressive. Let's take a look at the dynamic dude. Hey, come on now, Terry.
Going to be something for Lance Russell, who, of course, a legend in Memphis, a place where the pile driver is a move effectively equivalent with death, whereas it is a banned move, and it was Jerry Lawler's thing, and now you got Terry Funk doling out pile drivers on the floor willy-nilly here in the NWA. Iko Iko plays as a music video for a new team to the NWA, the Dynamic Dudes. And there's been so much said about the sheer embarrassment of the gimmick with all the neon and the skateboards. Johnny Ace could not ride a skateboard. Apparently, this was a Jim Ross idea to try and recreate the Rock and Roll Express, but with Johnny Ace, John Laurinaitis, bringing the people power in the late 1980s to the NWA, and Shane Douglas. And this video right here is really, really strange. First of all, this is a song at the time in 1989 was associated with the movie Rain Man. So I don't... it's kind of weird that they would use that song. I guess they must have gotten rights to it, or more likely, they didn't give a crap and just sort of threw the music on underneath. It starts out and they are eating pizza, but they are eating Sbarro pizza. And it's like, okay, who the hell do they think they are? Michael Scott from The Office, like, oh, New York City, this has my favorite pizza place. And it shows the Sbarro. And you can just imagine, like, the conversation between Johnny Ace and Shea Douglas. This is good pizza, huh? Good pepperoni. Yeah, I got it from a guy up the street named Dick Flair. Probably went something like that. And they show them shopping for bathing suits, which I thought was funny. And they play a little prank on a girl and they put a coat hanger on her back or whatever. I don't know what they were doing there. And they're picking out skateboards. And we see Johnny Ace do the little trick of bring the skateboard from the ground up to his hand and sort of grabs it. So great, great job, Johnny. Love that. And they show a couple of in-ring moves. I do like the slingshot back suplex that they do. They do a sort of doomsday device. The guy doesn't flip over, but he almost like lands directly on his head. It looked pretty freaking dangerous. But good Lord, if you do anything, just... You've got to see this video. It's about 20 minutes in to the episode on YouTube. Of course, I maintain the playlist, the Greetings from Allentown playlist on YouTube. You absolutely have to see this video if you've never seen it before. I mean, the two of them are eating Sbarro's pepperoni pizza. I mean, what can I really add to that? I mean, Sbarro is perfectly fine if you're in a rest area. I'm presuming they're not in a rest area there. Why are they eating Sbarro? Then again, I'm thinking the southern United States probably did not have the best pizza places in 1989, so maybe I'm judging too much here. At least with Sbarro, you knew what you were getting. And all I really know right now is that I'm really hungry for pizza. And as I record this, I'm at a time of the day at, actually it's 12:22 in the morning right now, that I damn well better not be eating pizza. So let's just go right into the next match here, which is the Fabulous Freebirds in the form of Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy taking on George South and Trent Knight. And George South is an enhancement talent who needs absolutely no introduction, having worked in the NWA for quite a while by this point, and he would be working WWF shows also at various times in 1989. There was a match where it's him and Tim Horner versus the Brainbusters, which was totally out of Techwood Studios, that I believe I've referenced in the past and made a match of the day on my blog at section309.com at one point. Trent Knight, he has a red satin jacket on, so he immediately gets my endorsement, and I just I adore the fact that the back of his red satin jacket just says Trent Knight in the most plain lettering you could have possibly found. Now, finally, we get our inset promo from Lex Luger, and he, as I had mentioned earlier, is very agitated about the rankings. And again, I can't say that I blame him, because he was the U.S. champion and de facto number one contender, and he loses through a complete screw job, and all of a sudden he's knocked down to number four?
You know, everybody said, Lex, now that you've had a week to cool off, sit back and really think things out. Be the Lex Luger everybody wants you to be. Go back after Michael Hayes. You're damn straight. I'm going after Michael Hayes. But it's not the Lex Luger you're used to seeing. I'm sick and tired. I've had it up to here by playing by the rules all the time. Good old Lex Luger. It's going to be a different Lex Luger. It's time for Lex Luger to come unwrapped just a little bit. It's time for Lex Luger to step forward on his own. I'm sick and tired of trying to please everyone else in my life. It's time for Lex Luger, and don't anybody, mark my words right now, stand in my way, because I'm coming after what's mine, and that's the U.S. heavyweight title, Michael Hayes.
That's one of those things. Lex's speech pattern there is something that works very well in that promo, but outside of a professional wrestling setting, the kind of short, loud bursts of energy there, like Lex ordering in a restaurant, yes, I will have the prime rib, please. And how would you like that cooked, sir? I would like it cooked medium rare. And what sides would you like? I would like baked potato and a side salad with Thousand Island dressing. Like, it doesn't really work quite as effectively, or it makes him sound crazy, quite frankly. But there, he's vowing to get back at Michael Hayes, and given the way that he lost the title, it would be only a matter of time before he would get it back. There's not much to this Freebirds match here, although Lance points out that the Freebirds have got to be considered a top contender for the tag team tournament, which, of course, in today's WWE would be a no-no because they would end up winning. And, of course, you're not allowed to predict the winner before something happens. Oh, that'll give it away. But, yeah, they, of course, ended up winning the tournament. And, as I said, Jimmy Garvin would replace Terry Gordy, and somehow they wouldn't miss a beat, even though the Freebirds would more or less suck from that point forward. Michael Hayes, as an in-ring worker, he has a great working punch, But other than that, there's not a whole lot to go on here. His clothesline that he doles out at one point here is extremely crappy. And Knight actually hurts his left knee while running the ropes, and either he is one hell of a salesman, or he really did hurt his knee there. Gordy gets in, and he goes on to win the match with a half crab. So very unusual. He works the bad leg there. It's just very strange to see a match end on a half crab, which just reminds me, I pretty much ate all the crab I could eat when I was in Baltimore last weekend. I think I had crab at every single meal. I had soft shell crab at Camden Yards, which is one of the best ballpark food things that you can get in all of the major leagues, although I do like the Orlando Cepeda nachos that you can get out at AT&T Park in San Francisco. So yeah, half crab, that's pretty much the only kind of crab I didn't have. A crab dip. Like, literally, Maryland for food is a really great place. Of course, you gotta like crab. That's a must. And you have to be willing to have Old Bay seasoning on all your food, or at the very least, kind of empty an Old Bay thing on a table, take a razor blade and put it into a line and actually snort it. That is required if you're not going to have it on your food in the great state of Maryland. Redirecting to get my mind off food and snorting Old Bay seasoning, Freebirds have a promo here, and it's not so much what they're saying that bugs me here, it's that I've come to a realization that Terry Gordy is not at all an attractive man. His hair is awful. His face is just really, really pudgy. Like, I don't know why I'm noticing this for the first time now, just how, I don't want to say sensationally ugly he is, but he is far from an attractive man, even in 1989 when he was still pretty young. I think he was still under 30 years old at that point. Lance suggests to them that there's no way that they're going to hold off Lex Luger in his quest to get the United States title back from Michael Hayes. And Lance once again proves to be the sage and is correct, as Lex would win the title back 2 days later from the airing of this episode, assuming that this aired on May 20th. Luger won the title back on May 22nd at, I guess the match was taped for TV, but it's listed as a house show in Bluefield, West Virginia, which seems like one of the weirder and smaller places that you would ever have a title change. The closest other city of note to it is at Blacksburg, West Virginia. It's really on the edge of the state. In fact, it's kind of a Kansas City thing with Bluefield, West Virginia, in that there's a Bluefield, West Virginia, and a Bluefield, Virginia. So you have to kind of differentiate between the two. So yeah, that's where they got the U.S. title back on Lex Luger, and he would hold that for a good year and a half before dropping it to Stan Hansen in 1990. So certainly one of the longest title reigns of really any kind in the NWA during that era. Matchup now of two well-traveled individuals, Dick Murdoch and the Raider. No, not Tim Brown or Marcus Allen or any of the then Los Angeles Raiders. Talking about longtime enhancement talent, Randy Barber, who you name the promotion, and he worked there at least once. He worked in Continental. He worked in Georgia, which is where he kind of made his name. Jim Crockett Promotions, even worked in WWF for a while, mostly under the mask as the Raider. You name it. He was pretty much all over the map. Championship Wrestling from Florida. He passed away on New Year's Day in 2008 at the age of 49, so we lost him far too soon. Dick Murdoch, of course, He was everywhere over the course of his lengthy career, finding a home in the NWA in 1988 with a brief reunion of the Texas Outlaws with Dusty Rhodes. With Dusty out the door, Murdoch stuck around for through the spring and summer in the NWA. He did stop and make a visit to New Japan in the summer months, but he was back in the NWA by the fall, but not for long. As you get to December, he's teaming with Atsushi Onita in FMW. So he was kind of a lot like Terry Funk in that he would stamp his own ticket. He would kind of wander wherever the hell he felt like going. And Terry kind of pointed out some issues that Murdoch had in kind of lost in the shuffle of the NWA of 1989. I also couldn't do too much to help my old friend Dick Murdoch. Dick was working for the NWA in 1989, but he didn't last long after I got there. We were having one of our meetings in the dressing room with Hurd trying to figure out what was wrong with the company. When Murdoch walked by, Hurd had always liked Murdoch. So he called him in and said, "Dick, come in here and tell us what you think is wrong with the business." Murdoch said, "Well, Jim, it's you. You don't know a goddamn thing about this business." Well, hell, that was the truth. Jim Hurd's idea of a good concept for professional wrestling was the Ding Dongs. So yes, Dick Murdoch, always a straight shooter, and that did not help him in that case. He had beaten Bob Orton at WrestleWar in that weird bull rope match that was something less than the sum of its parts. Bob Orton, of course, a excellent worker. Dick Murdoch, always entertaining and a pretty good worker as well, but for some reason it just didn't add up to anything resembling entertaining. But Dick Murdoch was always a fun watch. He was always kind of comically stumbling around and all that. And the knock on him is that Murdoch didn't take wrestling seriously enough. If he had simply been more serious about it, he could have been a world champion. Well, you know what? I mean, he is what he is. He was true to his personality. I would say this to really anybody in life, that if you can be true to yourself and who you are, then really, that's all that really matters. And Dick Murdoch had entertained a hell of a lot of people, and he certainly had a memorable career, despite not holding a world title. I mean, people still talk. Hell, I'm talking about him on a freaking podcast, you know, in the middle of the night. So, you know, there's something to be said about that. I do. Murdoch goes for the mask here, which is fantastic. It goes to my thing of, if you unmask the guy and nobody really knows who he is, I mean, I guess people would have known Randy Barber, maybe, but well, just unmasking a guy like, oh, we don't know who that is. Like the old Ed Whalen thing in Stampede with the Zodiac, Barry O getting unmasked there. Just not a whole lot of moves here from Murdoch. It's not like a wild and crazy ball. It's just a quick little squash match, a backdrop. And then a very long, delayed vertical suplex by Murdoch. He held him up there for a good 10 to 15 seconds. And he mentioned that the Great American Bash is coming up. And that would be interesting for Murdoch, as the results for him is he was losing to Mike Rotunda around the horn, which seems kind of odd. But Murdoch was up there in years, and Rotunda was still fairly pushed at that point in 1989, even as the Varsity Club was winding up. And Dick Murdoch, of course, as I said, he would come back in the fall for a brief spell, but he could always go to Japan. He could go wherever he really wanted and kind of in a pinch. Like I said, he's a lot like Terry Funk in many, many ways.
His name is Dalton.
You don't look like much to me.
Opinions vary.
He's the best there is.
Damn, that hurts, doesn't it?
He says he's nice.
I want you to be nice.
Always nice.
I know you're not a nice guy.
Until it's time not to be nice.
He's real good.
Roadhouse, rated R.
Starts Friday at selected theaters.
Oh, I'm in. Who's with me? It's funny, the first time I saw Roadhouse was actually kind of an interesting story. I managed to not see it on cable for all of the 1990s, despite the fact that it was on literally all the time on
any number of different channels. So I'm out with two of my friends, the same two friends I actually went to Chicago and Milwaukee with a few weeks back. And the topic of Roadhouse came up, and I said that I had never seen the movie. And immediately they stopped, kind of like that record screech sound that I'm quite fond of. And we had to go back to one of their houses and immediately have an emergency showing of the movie so that I could watch it for myself. So we actually did that for Airplane as well later that year. So that became something of a thing. Go back to Joe Pedicino here for Joe Pedicino Knows. And he's telling us about the Grand Slam contest, which is it who can eat the most Grand Slam breakfasts or whatever? But no, that's not what he's talking about here. Their thing is you are to write in and say, oh, who's your favorite NWA wrestler and da-da-da-da-da. And it seems like one of those collect names for a mailing list, except for the fact that I don't think WCW was savvy enough to do something like that, at least around this time. I mean, they seemed like they were trying to do similar things to what the WWF was doing, but couldn't quite ever execute it in the same way. Prizes for this contest include VCRs. He said plural. I presume you wouldn't win two VCRs, although that would come in handy for another of the prizes, which is a bunch of Turner Home Entertainment wrestling tapes, so that if you had multiple VCRs, you can then dub those tapes and either sell them or trade them or however you want to do it. Another prize is a trip for two to Baltimore. Baltimore is a very different city in 1989. The Inner Harbor, they were starting to revamp that a bit into what it is now, kind of a tourist destination. It's a really nice walk if you're in Baltimore for a weekend just to walk around the brick promenade all the way around. It's a couple of miles and definitely worth your time. I do wish that I had applied a little bit more sunblock when I did that last Saturday, because I have like a definite tan line that ends at the end of my neck there. Baltimore, Charm City, not a place maybe where you could spend a full week's vacation unless you were going to travel to Philadelphia or Washington, which is an easy drive away in either direction. But a weekend in Baltimore, I could recommend that. There are a lot of good restaurants in the city, more than what you might think, and not just like in the Inner Harbor area. If you go to the east, to the Fells Point area, you have the Heavy Seas Ale House, which is a terrific brewery. Actually, their main brewery is in suburban Baltimore, and a number of great restaurants in Fells Point, such as the Abbey's Burger Bistro, although they also have a location in Federal Hill as well. And I also recommend the Thames Street Oyster House, because not only do they have lots of different types of oysters from all over North America, but they actually describe the oysters on their menu, which is nice because you'd like to know what you're getting when you order a blah, 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 or a Miyagi oyster from British Columbia. It's nice to know what you're getting, and they provide that there. So enough of my Baltimore travel tips, as Joe Pedicino has a question for Terry Funk. Why did you do it? Why did you attack Ric Flair? Well, we've already established there were a number of different reasons. He suggested, was it to get himself back into the top 10 in title contention? I have suggested that it is long game revenge for John Ayers being shown up on television last year. Who knows? And Pedicino makes an interesting comment. He's outraged that the NWA Board of Directors would give a permit to Terry Funk to wrestle, which they did the previous week. I'm trying to consider what the NWA's permitting process was. I'm pretty sure it wasn't too stringent, since the Ding Dongs came along not long after this point in time. You see a clip of Ric Flair actually winning the title against Ricky Steamboat with kind of a, looks like the same kind of screwed up small package as the end of Steamboat's match from WrestleMania 3, except that the Dragon is on the other side of it this way. So, it's a fantastic match all the way around. And there's a lot of discussion of, oh, which is your favorite of the Flair Steamboat trilogy? And I consider it actually a four-match series because I throw in the match from Landover, Maryland, the famous house show match from March of 1989, which is actually available on YouTube. And I love it as a watch, and I've probably mentioned this in a previous episode. There is no commentary on the match, so when you're watching it, you feel like a fan in the front row of the balcony watching Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat in 1989. In fact, I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch that definitely later this week. But as for the three trilogy matches, I might be out to lunch here, and I might need to watch the Clash 6 match again. And in fact, maybe I should just schedule an entire day of Flair Steamboat 89 viewing for myself. My favorite one is the Chi-Town Rumble, just based on it's the most accessible match. If I were to show a Flair Steamboat match to somebody, I would probably show that one first, and not just for, you know, the happy ending there. Although, I guess, you know, with the cheers at the end of Wrestle War, it was kind of a happy ending for the fans there as well. And I actually rank Wrestle War second, which means that I guess I would rank the Clash match third, which may make me sound crazy because it's certainly one of the greatest matches of all time. It's one of the greatest near hour long matches of all time. I think a lot of it is that that one is a little bit less accessible. There's that word again, because of the length involved. But then again, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, they make 45 minutes feel like 20 minutes. So it's really not a knock on them. It's just kind of a matter of personal taste on my part.
Legalized from school are we, prettiest schoolgirl well can be, filled to the brim with girlish glee. Three little girls from school, everything is a source of fun.
That's the Simpsons singing Three Little Maids from the Gilbert and Sullivan comic opera The Mikado, which came out in 1885. And yes, I must admit that my knowledge of Gilbert and Sullivan is almost entirely derived from The Simpsons, although there was an HMS Pinafore episode of Mr. Belvedere where Wesley was in the play at school and was singing all the same lines that you hear in that Cape Fear episode where Sideshow Bob is on the boat and Bart has him sing the entire score of the HMS Pinafore. It's one of the more enjoyable Simpsons moments of all time. But let it not distract us from this grand battle of the bookers we have here between Kevin Sullivan and Eddie Gilbert, or more accurately, Eddie Gilbert and Kevin Sullivan. So Gilbert and Sullivan are going at it here. By the way, the real Gilbert and Sullivan was W.S. Gilbert and Arthur Sullivan. So there you have it there. Sullivan is in the ring, and of course is from Charlestown, Massachusetts, which he's billed from Boston, but the neighborhood that he was from is Charlestown. And Gilbert, of course, comes out to the song Hot Stuff by Donna Summer. Donna Summer, also a Boston native who grew up in the Mission Hill District. And knowing Boston neighborhoods as I do, Charlestown and Mission Hill are the same city, but I can tell you that they are kind of worlds apart demographically and racially and all that. So we get a brawl to start, and there was a heated issue between these two guys that was supposed to culminate in a hair versus hair match, or I guess a haircut match at the pay-per-view, where it was Eddie Gilbert and Rick Steiner versus Kevin Sullivan and Dan Spivey. Now, originally, it was Eddie Gilbert who was to lose his hair in that match. Obviously, that did not end up happening because a few things got in the way there. One of which was that Rick Steiner ended up tearing a bicep not long before that and really could not work the match or even take off his jacket. So he got run into the ring post and was out of the match for much of the time since he couldn't work. With that injury in mind, they were going to change the finish to have Kevin Sullivan lose the match and lose his hair, but he refused to do it because, well, quite frankly, there wasn't a whole lot left there. Though this is the promotion that did Paul Ellering versus Teddy Long in a hair versus hair match the following year when literally they have less hair between them than like is on my arms right now. So whatever. On the pay-per-view, we got a cockamamie explanation from Jim Ross saying that the NWA board of directors would not permit such a match and that they would have to settle it on their own time and terms. So there you have it. And they get a quick brawl here to start. And Sullivan leaves the ring and chases Missy Hyatt around. And actually, she runs to the back. And what a creeper Kevin Sullivan is with all these angles with women in a really kind of short period of time. Although I guess the one with woman and Benoit came later on, which is certainly the creepiest of them all. But it faces stiff competition with the precious thing from the year before, which was, you know, he hit her and all this sort of stuff. And then he's running around chasing after Missy Hyatt. So that's three of them right there. There's probably another one that I don't even remembering right now. Caudill makes the point, though, that now that Missy did go to the back and is safe and away from Kevin Sullivan, that Gilbert will not be distracted by her on the outside and what Sullivan might try to go after her if he was down or something like that. So I feel that was a good point made in kayfabe there. Sullivan with a back rake. Who does he think he is? Heel Hulk Hogan here? Or is he channeling General Adnan or Sheik Adnan LKC, as he was known at this time? They head outside. Sullivan is in control. Notice that there's no railing between the fans and the ring, which for 1989, I would have thought that there would have been railings would have been standard in all arenas by that point, but I guess not. Gilbert is sent into the ring post, which is what injured Rick Steiner in kayfabe, and Caudill and Russell say that it's shades of what they did to Rick Steiner at WrestleWar. Eddie Gilbert, to me, and I've seen him on WWF television in 83 and 84, as he's really, really young and not much of anything in terms of a character, although there was a disturbing segment where he is training with Bob Backlund and is just yelling like he's down in the root cellar or something with Buffalo Bill getting tortured. I don't. Maybe I should just do that episode of Championship Wrestling if I could ever find it. It's from, I think, November of 1983. And I could cross 1983 off my list. But Eddie Gilbert is a really, really excellent salesman as a babyface. And he was really, I guess, never better in that regard during this era than at Clash 4 with that very long tag match for the U.S. title. It was actually a tournament final between the Fantastics and Eddie Gilbert and Ron Simmons. And he was facing peril for much of that match. And he's really, really good in that role. And I could definitely see him as a cool babyface type who could really sell, and then make the big comeback. But he never really kept his head on 100% straight. And also maybe the desire to be a heel. And of course, he was very effective in that role, as I covered in episode 21, when he tricked Bill Watts into the ring and laid him out along with the Russians who were under his guidance. And then they laid the flag on the cowboy. Gilbert has control on the outside and lays in some right hands. But now a third famous booker decides he wants to be part of this battle of the bookers, and that is Paul E. Dangerously. He sends in the Samoan SWAT team as his proxies, and they beat the hell out of Eddie Gilbert, drag him into the ring, and just sort of hold him up so that Kevin Sullivan can throw some right hands. There's some LOD chants from the crowd, and I am 100% expecting them to run out and make the save for Eddie Gilbert, but they are nowhere to be found, and they just leave Eddie Gilbert laying and walk away.
Come all, I tell you, threw the referee out of there Dangerously. They didn't strip him of a title. They should have stripped him of his senses. I think somebody already did. Now look at how it developed with Gilbert on the floor, with Sullivan pounding away on, with Gilbert pounding Sullivan. SST jumps him, Paul Dangerously directing traffic, Bob.
Go to the interview. Lance Russell, and he is with the Road Warriors and Paul Ellering. So I guess they were available for an interview, but they were not available to save Eddie Gilbert. I guess the Hawk must have been on the can and Animal must have been lifting weights or something like that. And Ellering does all the talking here. And as a manager, he's an okay talker. I'll admit that. As a manager, I don't think he was particularly needed, except, oddly enough, in real life. Because it seems like Hawk's issues got worse when they went to the WWF, and Paul Ellering was not with them when they went there in 1990. Of course, he would come in 92 with that unfortunate Rocco business, which, God help me if I ever have to try to explain that one. But as a manager, I mean, he was overpaid because he was paid about as much as the LOD was. So it was a very expensive package to have these three guys, which is why the Road Warriors were allowed to walk in 1990, because they were, their cost was outweighing their benefit at that point. I will give this for Paul Ellering, though, who is, of course, now the manager of the Authors of Pain in NXT, who are the NXT Tag Team Champions as I speak. I do enjoy the beating that he took at the hands of Split Pants Ole Anderson at the last Battle of Atlanta. Sure, the Buzz Sawyer versus Tommy Rich match gets all the attention, and rightfully so. But that second part with Ole Anderson and Paul Ellering, and Ole just beating the crap out of him with his tremendous working punch and having his pants split on him and all that stuff, I enjoyed that just as much as the Sawyer Rich stuff, which, I don't know, that must say something about me. After all, I'm the guy who ranks the Clash 6 match third in the Flair Steamboat trilogy. The LOD actually says very little, and Animal says nothing. And during the interview, they showed a clip of a match with the Samoan SWAT team and the Road Warriors, and I'm noticing one thing, is that the officials are abused by both teams. The Samoans hit the referee as they're about to count three, as the referee is about to count three, after a doomsday device, and then a second referee comes in, and the Road Warriors throw him over the top rope and out of the ring. So my question is, if you're going to ban the Varsity Club from the tag team tournament, which, who knows, maybe it had already started or whatever, but you could have had them forfeit or something. Why are they allowed to be in the tag team tournament? Samoan SWAT team and the Road Warriors are both in the tag team tournament, but they're abusing officials. And not only that, they're abusing officials who are not wrestlers. Okay, that should be considered on a different level. They beat up Nikita Koloff, Spivey, and Sullivan. Nikita, the whole idea of him being a special ref is he should be able to defend himself. But if it's like Tommy Young getting thrown out of the ring, that should be treated more harshly than them beating up Nikita Koloff. So really, that kind of makes no sense. Go back to Coddle and Russell, and they appear to be wrapping up the show. And I noticed that Bob Coddle has the blue microphone, which, given the fact that Bob Coddle worked for Senator Jesse Helms, he should probably have the red microphone, I think. Although Coddle is definitely on the right here, the far, far, far right. But wait, we do have one final item of business here on the show, and we have what Coddle... we're very used to the Gary Michael Capetta introduction of Flyin' Brian. But at this time, Pillman is just coming into the promotion, so Coddle calls him...
Take a look at a great new star who is on his way to the NWA, Flying Brian.
I guess the G is left in there to indicate that he actually does fly things like machinery in addition to flying through the air. So if he's Flying Brian, he's just a guy who soars through the air off the top rope, which they do show him landing a splash to the back of some enhancement talent. But they also show him in a helicopter, flying a helicopter, although he's not at the controls there. And he's flying over Atlanta, which is unmistakable because that is Atlanta Fulton County Stadium that you see at one point. It's, even though it is a concrete bowl like many stadiums built in the mid-1960s, it's fairly recognizable compared to, say, Three Rivers or Veterans Stadium or one of those. Show him throwing some drop kicks. And around this time, they were also doing vignettes for Scott Hall, who came into the NWA for a very, very brief and forgettable run in 1989. In fact, I don't even remember Scott Hall on any major shows or participating in any angles until he was back in 1991 as the Diamond Stud.
Pillman had, of course, much more success, even in 1989. He had a feud with Lex Luger late in the year, and kind of the slow introduction of Pillman. His first big match is at the Great American Bash, where he scored a victory over Wild Bill Irwin, a fun match which I remember most for during the heat segment, Irwin yelling audibly, "Come on, Flying Brian, fly!" And I remember every time I just watch that, it cracks me up, Bill Irwin's antics. And that does it for the show proper, but right now, we have the dramatic return of YouTube Comment Theater. And this video has been up for over a year at this point, so praise be to God for keeping this on YouTube for that long. And there are a couple of comments here that I would like to get to at the very least. Rick T says, "Tom Branch, LOL, stop that. You're Tom Renesto, dummy." Yes, Tom Branch is actually Tom Renesto Jr., who's the son of one of the assassins. And I didn't really get into that because I've kind of, in an effort to trim this show down, which is a weird thing to say as I hit the 1 hour and 50 minute mark right now, I've kind of cut back on jobber bios lately, that will come back at some point. But there haven't been as many squash matches on the shows that I've been doing. I mean, on Main Event, it was two matches. Next week, there's not going to be any real jobber matches either. I'll get to that in a minute. Sean Rankin says, "I think Michael Hayes was U.S. champion for 2 weeks at best." Well, you would be wrong, Sean Rankin, because Michael Hayes was U.S. champion for 15 days, which is one more day than 2 weeks, which is what you said he was at best. So I'm going to issue a snobbish, obnoxious correction there. Old School Brawlers is on the complete other end of the spectrum for me. "Damn nice Simmons match. Not often you see Simmons with a worthy opponent willing to dish it out on him." And who knows, maybe they were a little stiff, I don't know, but it did not look like a good match, and I didn't enjoy it in the least. So it's just a reminder that taste is a subjective thing. I don't understand why everybody gets so upset about Dave Meltzer's star ratings. He's going to enjoy what he enjoys, and I wouldn't take everything that anybody says as complete gospel. You need to get as many opinions as possible to kind of form your own opinion. And also, see stuff for yourself. Like, I can't comment on the Kenny Omega and Okada matches in Japan. You know why? Because I haven't seen them. I am amused by the reaction to Dave Meltzer's ratings of them, with the whole 6 stars and 6 1/4. Obviously, Dave Meltzer likes Japanese wrestling, and that's fine. That is his right. And there are, you know, many people on Pro Wrestling Only who feel the same way. Cub35 guy says, and it points to the 1844 mark of the video, "Funk pile drives Bruce on the floor. Damn hot." The immediate reply from Steve Lane, not Stan Lane, "That pile driver was the truth. Damn." Well, it was pretty good, but it is not the truth. Paul Pierce is the truth. Steve Lane also commented, "Was the monitor sitting on a bucket during the Terry Funk segment?" Yes, it probably was, or maybe they put it on a chair or a stool. I don't know. They actually did show the studio area where Caudill and Russell were stationed, but I didn't get a look and see where the monitor was that they were looking at when Terry Funk was doing his crazy promo when they were watching the clip of him pile-driving Ric Flair and beating on him on the floor. Jason PDSI says, "They pushed the shit out of Muda." And yes, they did give him a strong push through the middle of 1989, but by the end of the year, it was all over, in part because Gary Hart, his manager, was very determined to keep the great Muta as a heel, even though it would have been the best thing for his career in reality to become a silent babyface killer, as I mentioned earlier. But Gary Hart, if he doesn't have the great Muda in his stable, what exactly is his purpose there? What is his raison d'etre, you know? And Gary Hart wasn't even around in the NWA for very long after that part in early 1990. You don't see him by the summer of 1990. So that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Before I go for this week, though, I kind of want to send a shout-out here to Keith Langston, the first listener to this show from way back when. Not sure how old he is today. He could either be 70, 26, or 100. I'm not entirely sure. If he was 100, I would bring in Willard Scott to do that. So just a quick shout out to him, since he was the first person who listened to the show when I was a little show on SoundCloud that nobody really knew about, although me and Keith are actually friends, so we're good. So for next week's show, of course, this is the Fortnight of Funk. So a fortnight means we got to have a second week of Terry Funk. And oh, you're going to have to drag me kicking and screaming to talk about Terry Funk again. So here, since we got him in the NWA, why don't we take a look at him next week in the World Wrestling Federation in one of his most high-profile matches against Hulk Hogan, Saturday night's main event, in January of 1986. And in addition to that Hogan-Funk match, which, as I've mentioned a million times, I really enjoy, there's all the WWF silliness that they were putting into the Saturday Night Main Event around that time. Guys hanging around outside by a pool, as this was taped in Tampa, Florida, in December of 1985. You have a six-man tag with Roddy Piper, Jesse Ventura. You know, they sound like they would make a good tag team someday on television. They are joining Bob Orton to take on the Hillbillies, a hillbilly Jim, God help us, Uncle Elmer, and God freaking help us, Cousin Luke, in six-man action. The first Randy Savage versus George Steele match on Saturday Night's Main Event, which I believe there was 35 of them, even though I don't even think there were 35 Saturday Night's Main Events, just felt like there were that many. Nikolai Volkov against Corporal Kirshner, who has been a source of much consternation on the Place to Be podcast as they roll through 1986 and the end of Kirshner's run with the company. And a tag match to wrap up. Junkyard Dog, Ricky Steamboat taking on Mr. Fuji and the Magnificent Morocco. And in addition to that, there's quite an amusing music video that they put into the show that's dubbed over on the network, but I was able to get a copy of the original music that was used on it, which was a Billy Ocean song. So more on that next week. So do tune in then for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Be quiet.